hour, the bar was open for business. It was also manned by a barman who would not look out of place on the cover of Esquire magazine. No wonder these old lushes come here at this hour with talent like this serving them, Ruby thought, as their eyes briefly met. They're over there in the corner, near the back door, Richard said, pointing to the group of women he recognised from social media. Sipping their gin and tonics, the women did not appear to notice Ruby until she was halfway across the room. Dressed in a mixture of linen trousers, floaty dresses, and butterfly print chiffon tops, they turned to greet her with curious glances as she approached their table. After introducing herself, Ruby allowed the flutter of excitement to die down before taking a seat. Her nose twitched as the cloud of expensive perfume enveloping them threatened to make her sneeze.
"Are you here about Cheryl and Melissa?"
a petite, auburn-haired woman inquired. Her face was tight and worried as she clasped her glass in both hands. "Yes," Ruby confirmed, shocked that news of Cheryl's disappearance had spread so quickly. "I was wondering if any of you can shed any light on their whereabouts." But questioning seemed fruitless as the six women gathered stated they knew nothing of the plans of either woman on the day of their disappearances. Friends seemed to be a loose term as they preferred to gossip over Melissa and Cheryl's financial status rather than show empathy and genuine concern. "How did you come to know each other?" Ruby said, aware of their eyes raking over her as they made their own mental calculations. Designer suit, expensive watch, and ooh, a pair of Jimmy Choo suede ankle boots. Ruby could almost hear their thoughts. But such items had been gifted by Nathan, and were not as a result of her mediocre sergeant's wage.
"We're the golf widows,"
a woman named Amelia replied with a smile. "We meet up once a week as our husbands are often away on business. Gordon rang us this morning to ask if we knew where Cheryl was. We've not known poor Melissa for very long. She was very quiet, didn't seem very interested in what we had to say."
"She's a good 20 years younger than us, Amelia,"
a dark-haired woman named Shirley piped up in a cynical tone. "Of course she wasn't interested, but we were all shocked to hear of the kidnapping. That's what it was, wasn't it? A ransom gone wrong?" "I'm afraid I can't say," Ruby said, sensing their hunger for the truth. Richard had excused himself to use the bathroom and seemed to be taking an incredibly long time. Ruby wondered how an introvert such as Richard could be attracted to a role in the police. "What about Cheryl?" Amelia said, pausing to sip her G&T. "Has she been kidnapped too?" "I was hoping you might be able to help me with that. Do you know of any other social groups, meeting places, social events she could have attended recently?" The women shook their heads, all delivering a blank stare. Ruby inhaled a deep breath as she took the decision to share some information on the case. "What about clubs? Nightlife? Any of you go out on the town while your husbands are away?" Shirley's eyes flickered momentarily before she swiftly shook her head, staring into her empty glass. "I'm going to get another round," she said. "Can I tempt any of you ladies? It's been quite a shocking week."
"I'll come with you," Ruby said, quickly recognizing the appeal for privacy.
They were barely at the bar before Ruby swooped in. Richard would not be too pleased at being left to deal with the gaggle of women upon his return, but there was no fear of them getting very much out of him. "You know, don't you?" Ruby said firmly, as Shirley placed her order from the Adonis at the bar. "You know where Melissa and Cheryl went." Shirley paled, clearly shaken.
"If they find out I've told you..."
"If you don't cooperate, then Cheryl could die. Is that what you want?"
"You can't tell my husband."
She hesitated, checking over her shoulder before lowering her voice. "I know I'm getting on, but there's life in this old girl yet." "Nobody will know,
I'll put you down as an anonymous source. Please, Shirley, Melissa's dead and Cheryl might not have long left. Plucking a card from the back pocket of her trousers, Shirley slid it across the bar. Ruby cupped it with her hand.
I'm never recommending that place again, Shirley said. If Melissa died because of me...
Melissa died because a psychopath strangled the life out of her. She ran her thumb over the velvety black embossed card, the word debauchery styled in red. Underneath was an unusual-looking web address, and beside it what looked like a password.
Who gave you this? What else do you know?
That's as much as I can tell you, Shirley said, smiling sweetly at the barman as he approached to take payment for her drinks. She seemed reluctant to speak until he turned away, then looked at Ruby as if to ask what she was still doing there.
You're hiding something. Who's your source? Ruby said, pocketing the card.
I don't remember, Shirley said, glancing over her shoulder at her group of friends.
Someone slipped me some cards at a party. I don't know who they were.
A woman's life is at stake, Ruby said, gripping Shirley's wrist as she reached for the tray of drinks.
You think I want this?
Shirley jerked back her arm, her eyes wide.
Cheryl was my friend. If I could help you, I would. But I've told you all I know.
Ruby took the hint, leaning over to deliver one last piece of advice. Don't even think about using them again, and not a word of this to anyone.
You don't need to worry on that score. From now on, it's monogamy all the way, Shirley said, fixing a stiff smile as the barman returned with her change.
The urgent buzz of Ruby's phone cut into her thoughts as she and Richard returned to the car. It was the ringtone of a person sure to gain her immediate attention. But Kathy knew better than to contact her at work. A call from her meant something was wrong. Ruby clicked in her seatbelt, preparing to ring back as a text popped up on her screen. Help me. I'm being kept a prisoner. Come quick. Ruby balked as she stared at the screen. She had hated her daughter living with the head of the Crosby family, and now it seemed that her worst fears were coming true. There was nothing in briefing this morning about a raid on their home address. It led to a far more frightening conclusion. Had the Crosbys' underworld connections turned upon them? If so, just what kind of danger was her daughter in? Her heart hammering, Ruby's hands trembled as she tried to call Kathy's number. The dead ringtone that ensued made her blood run cold.
Chapter 22.
What's all the fuss about?
Nathan's mum, Frances Crosby, answered the door. Despite her diminutive stature, her expression was fierce, and in any other given situation, Ruby would not be approaching her home in such an aggressive manner. But there was no point in her feigning surprise, given the CCTV had captured Ruby's car upon entering the drive. It had been difficult to tear herself away from work now a new development had come in. After a hurried phone call to D.I. Downs, he had agreed to cover for her while she found out what was going on with Kathy. Any normal parent would have called the police and allowed them to deal with the situation. But Ruby knew that the presence of any other member of law enforcement could serve to make things a whole lot worse. She would deal with this alone. That's if she got out of here in one piece. Regardless of her relationship with Nathan, when at Frances Crosby's home address, Ruby never felt like she was on safe ground. Today, anxiety dictated her movements, and she needed to know what was going on.
Why have I received a text from my daughter saying she's being kept a prisoner in her own home?
Frances snorted, her hands on her hips as she spoke.
You what? That girl wants for nothing.
As always, she was immaculately turned out. Dressed in a pink satin blouse and cream-coloured skirt, her clothing gave no clues of her background, at least not until she opened her mouth and her East End accent spilled out. Ruby approached the wide stairwell, her voice echoing upwards as she spoke.
Then call her down here so I can see for myself.
She strained her neck as she called her daughter's name, hoping Lenny would not appear.
Kathy, are you up there? Come here and explain yourself.
Ruby knew it would take time to heal the rift between her and the daughter she gave up for adoption. She was ill acquainted with motherhood, and Kathy had insisted she stayed with the Crosbys after tracking them down online. But today, Ruby's heart burst with protectiveness, the memory of Melissa's death still fresh in her mind.
Oh, Kathy said, a smile touching her face. What are you doing here?
Dressed in faded dungarees and a striped crop top beneath, Kathy leaned over the top of the banisters, her dark hair trailing down her face. Ruby frowned at the sight of her daughter greeting her so nonchalantly, particularly given she had broken the speed limit to get there. She looked at her incredulously.
What am I doing here? You said you were in trouble. I tried calling you back, but the phone went dead.
Kathy descended the stairs in her stocking feet, two pink spots creeping onto her cheeks.
Sorry, my battery died. I didn't expect you to come racing over.
Well, I have, Ruby said, feeling foolish as she caught the smug grin on Francis's face. She returned her glance to Kathy, thinking she would never live this down.
So would you mind telling me what this is all about?
Best we bring this into the living room, Francis said, instructing Carla, her maid, to bring refreshments.
Ruby sighed, feeling all the anger evaporate like steam. She had forgotten what a hothead she herself had been in her youth, how one minute it was the end of the world, and seconds later peace had been restored. Now she realized why it always seemed to take everyone else a bit longer to catch up with her emotions.
Look, she said, I didn't come to start a fight. I've taken time off work to get here. I just want to know what's going on.
That makes two of us. Would you care to elaborate why you've been texting your mother while she's at work, Kathy?
Ruby raised an eyebrow, temporarily stilled by Frances's supportive words. It was the first time she had referred to her as Kathy's mother. Was she mellowing now that her relationship with Nathan was working out? Or had she given in to the inevitability that Ruby wasn't going away?
I'm sorry, Kathy said ruefully. But you're bang out of order, Nan. I'm in my 20s, a grown woman. I should be allowed to see who I want.
And you are, just not him,
Frances said, her face growing taut.
You'll thank me one day.
Ruby frowned as she took a seat in the living room. Dust motes danced in the generous shafts of sunlight beaming through the large sash windows. It was a beautiful space, complemented with expensive artwork and tasteful furnishings. Ruby glared at Kathy, unable to believe her ears. She was in a relationship? This was news to her.
Who? She said, expecting the name of some underworld gangster to roll off her tongue.
Darren, you know, from the block of flats where you used to live.
Oh, Ruby said.
She was aware of their friendship from when Kathy had visited her in the past. I didn't realize you were an item.
Not anymore, Kathy sulked, her mouth turned downwards into a childish frown. Which is why I'm moving out. Sorry, Francis, but I've made up my mind.
Hold up a minute, Ruby said. What's the problem with her seeing Darren? He's a nice kid, he works hard. He's a bit tied down looking after his mum, but...
His mum's dead and buried, Francis said. Silly bitch overdosed on smack last month.
She raised a hand as in self-defense.
And before you say anything, she didn't get that shit off my boys. We don't sell gear to the likes of her.
Ruby's mouth dropped open as she turned to her daughter, now perched on the sofa across the way.
I didn't know any of this. Why didn't you tell me? I would have gone to the funeral at the very least.
It wasn't that Ruby was particularly friendly with Darren's mum, but she had a lot of time for the young man who worked so hard to make something of his life. Gang violence was rife in the estate where he lived, yet he had grabbed the chance of an apprenticeship when Nathan called in some favours from the owners of an up-and-coming Shoreditch hotel. Kathy shrugged. "Because I thought you'd kick up a stink too. So you don't mind me seeing him?" "Of course not." Ruby frowned. "Why would I? He's not a user. It's not his fault he had such a rough start in life." Kathy glared at Francis for the answer. "Tell her, Nana. Tell her why you don't want me seeing him." Looking distinctly uncomfortable, Francis placed her cup on the table after taking a delicate sip. The contrast in her actions made for an amusing picture as the working-class woman in her fought for dominance. "Oh, for God's sake," she said, reverting back to her true self. "I don't mind Darren. He seems a nice enough lad, but he's just not good enough for a Crosby girl." Ruby winced as she realized where this was going. She pursed her lips as she tried to contain her disgust, reminding herself whose home she was in. But Frances was still talking, trying desperately to dig herself out of the hole she had just found herself in. "There's lots of nice lads interested in Kathy. I just want her mixing with the same sort," she appealed to Ruby, her face falling as she caught her look of disdain. Ruby took a deep breath as she tried to calm her response. "Are you saying you don't want him seeing Kathy because he's black?" she said, placing her cup on the coffee table and pushing it away. "What?" Francis said, looking from Ruby to Kathy. "No, of course not. What do you take me for?" Kathy interjected. "It's because of his mum. Can you believe the hypocrisy? She thinks Darren's not good enough because he's got no money and his mum took drugs." She folded her arms, scowling at Francis. "I'm not saying we're getting married or anything, but I'm old enough to make my own decisions about who I see." "I see." Ruby nodded in understanding, trying to voice her opinion as diplomatically as she could. Sure, Francis was as sweet as pie now, but she had seen her turn without warning in the past, and the last thing Ruby wanted was to be thrown out by her goons, the hired help who were never very far away. "Kathy's right. What's more, we're very fortunate to have her in our lives. As she said, she's a grown woman. She's managed to get by in life so far without us. We don't have any right to tell her what to do, much less inflict our personal beliefs on her." "I disagree," Frances said, her temper rising as the two women shot her down. "Just because you don't care about what she gets up to doesn't mean I can't have a say." "A say which is very outdated and not helping in the slightest," Ruby cut in. "Do you want to lose your granddaughter, is that it? Because that's what's going to happen. How do you think Nathan's going to react to this?" "It was Lenny that said it was a bad idea," Francis said. "He told me I had to intervene." Ruby's frown grew at the mention of his name. She knew Lenny could never resist the opportunity to stick the knife in. "And what does Lenny know about parenting, for that matter? What do any of us?" she said. "Kathy's not 12. The family dynamics are different, and we're all just settling into it. Don't you remember what happened when Nathan and I got together? How you tried to split us up? What was the result of that?" Frances paled, unable to reply. "Yes, that's right. We gave Kathy up for adoption, because we couldn't see a way we could stay together."
"I didn't know about the pregnancy," Frances said. "Things would have been different if you'd told me."
"We were too scared to approach you, terrified of what Jimmy might do," Ruby said, the mention of Nathan's father releasing a sense of oppression into the room. "You go laying down the law with Kathy, then history is going to repeat itself.
And if she ever has kids, you'll never get to see them. Is having your own way really that important to you?
Frances sighed.
Of course not. I just want what's best for Kathy, for all of us. Look, Ruby, I know I've been hard on you. It's taken me a long time to get over you joining the filth. But you and Nathan, well, it seems to be working, and I don't want to come between you.
She looked at her hands, now clasped on her lap, her fingers glistening from the diamond-encrusted rings bought from the proceeds of crime.
I'm not getting any younger. I just want us to be a family. Is that too much to ask?
Ruby's voice softened.
Of course it's not. But you're not a dictator. You can't impose your views on others no matter how strongly you feel.
She turned to Kathy. What is it you want? Kathy smiled, regarding her mother with newfound respect.
I want to see Darren, to be able to make my own choices. I've had my own way for a long time. Come in here. It's been nice to be around people who care, but I need my freedom too. Which is?
Frances said.
I'd like a place of my own, somewhere Darren can come and visit. I have a job now, and I'm applying for a better one once I finish my college course. I can't afford all the rent, but Dad won't mind helping me out until I can.
Ruby bit back her smile. She still couldn't get used to Nathan being referred to as Dad.
I'm sure he will, but he's still very protective of you. I'll broach the subject with him if you like.
I know you've had a tough time. I think Nathan likes the idea of you being looked after for once. Ruby sighed, the memory of her flat in the tower block still fresh in her memory.
Living on your own isn't all it's cracked up to be, believe me. And this house is huge enough that you can have your privacy.
As long as there's no limitations on who you can see. She looked at Frances pointedly.
Very well, Frances said. You can see who you want, but I don't want you bringing back fellas here. Not while Lenny's around anyway. It's not worth the grief I'm going to get.
Why don't we compromise? Ruby said. Kathy stays with me Saturdays and Sundays and lives here during the week. My flat's virtually empty at weekends as they're my busiest times at work. You can see Darren at my place and be close to work here.
Okay, Kathy said. But I'd still like a place of my own soon.
All in good time, Ruby smiled. Just let us mollycoddle you a bit longer. What do you say, Frances? Frances gave her a grateful smile.
Sounds good to me. I'm sorry about our misunderstanding. Let's hear no more about it.
Good, Ruby said, checking her mobile phone for any missed calls. A sense of relief filtered through when she saw there were none. Why was she here, sorting out her domestics when she should have been supporting her team? A sense of guilt rose from within as the urgency of her case hit home. I have to get back to work. I've got a double murder case on the go.
Sorry about the dramatics, Kathy said, following her to the door. I'll think before I text next time.
Make sure you do, Ruby said, giving her daughter a quick hug before saying goodbye. Speeding back to the police station, she was grateful to have made progress in her home life at the very least. Perhaps there was hope for their family after all. Her fingers tightened around the steering wheel as she took the shortcuts destined to cut time off her journey. Kathy's problems were dwarfed by what lay before her, and she admonished herself for her knee-jerk reaction that took her away from the case. The ring of her phone broke through her thoughts as it flashed up on the car hands-free display. Ruby stiffened. It was DCI Warrow. As she answered her call, she prepared her excuses about where she had been.
I'm glad I caught you, Warrow said, as Ruby answered the phone.
I'm just heading back to the station now, ma'am, Ruby said, flicking on her windscreen wipers as a sudden shower blurred her vision of the road ahead.
Then make a diversion, Waro said, her voice clipped. They're expecting you at the prison. I want you to pay another visit to Mason Gatley. Don't leave until you have answers. Time's running out, and the command team are asking questions. We've got just hours to save Cheryl Barber's life.
Chapter 23. It was not the best of starts to an informal interview, feeling like you were on the back foot. DCI Warrow's sudden insistence of a prison visit had left Ruby feeling unsettled. She was obviously pulling strings for her, desperate for a new lead. Unlike D.I. Downs, DCI Warrow was keen for Ruby to make her next move. It felt odd to have her DCI's approval and be at odds with Downs, who always had her back. Sitting in the prison, she tapped her nails on the table. She had ensured her shirt was buttoned up to the neck. Her hair was straightened, scraped back into a ponytail, and she had even wiped off her red lipstick for a natural look. Everything about her visit today was about putting on a professional front. She shuddered at the thought of being under Mason's control. He was the one locked away, she reminded herself. But deep down, she knew he held the key. He would feed from her emotions, enjoy watching her beg for a crumb of information that might catch the killer inspired by his evil acts. Nathan's words from the night before echoed in her mind. If he was worried about Mason's behaviour, then she had a right to be on her guard. She stiffened as he entered the room. Just as before, he was clean and tidy, his wavy hair brushed back from his face. His grey sweatshirt fit snugly over a well-defined chest, and Ruby guessed he took advantage of the prison gym. "Welcome back," he said, a smug smile touching his lips. But like before, the emotions etched on his face never quite reached his eyes. Ice blue, they reflected a coldness that emanated from his very soul. Ruby met his gaze, unflinching, as he pulled in his chair to be nearer to her. "You were right about the evidence," she said, happy to stroke his ego to get him on side. "Our killer has gone to great lengths to copy your previous M.O.
"Which was?" Mason said, looking pleased that someone had copied his pattern of procedure.
"It's confidential," Ruby replied. "But similar enough to make me realize that you've spoken to someone in detail about it."
"Is that so?" Mason said. "You surprise me, officer. I would have thought that an intelligent woman like you was capable of thinking outside the box."
Ruby shook her head. "It's not one of our own, if that's what you're hinting at."
"Oh, come on."
Mason emitted a thin laugh.
"Your team aren't loyal to you. They're loyal to the idea of you. When their desires change, so does their loyalty. Now I..."
He leaned forward, his fingers intertwined as he pushed his face closer to hers.
"I'd be loyal to you all day long."
His words silenced as he tested her limits, his eyes cold and unyielding, waiting for her to flinch. "Those who don't know the value of loyalty can never appreciate it," Ruby said, unwavering in her glare. "How have you managed to keep your American accent after all these years?" It was a good way of changing the subject, as well as turning things back onto him.
"I'm a British citizen," he said defensively.
"But you spent most of your childhood over there, living with your mother in a trailer park. I suppose some things aren't as easy to shake off, no matter how hard you try." She was referring to their last conversation, when she tried to work out his childhood and the motives behind his murders. "But I'm not here to play an armchair psychologist. We have another victim. Her husband has received 2 photos, as well as an amputated finger in the post. I won't try to appeal to your better nature because I know you don't have one. So what do I have to do to find out where she's being held?" Mason grinned,
leaning back in his chair and clasping his fingers behind his head.
A phone number.
Whose?
Yours.
Ruby frowned. What for?
Don't be coy. So I can talk to you, of course.
I'll see that my office number is left for you, she replied, knowing that was not what he meant. Mason glanced around the room before lowering his tone.
I'm not talking about ringing during office hours. Come on, Ruby. You know we have access to phones in here.
I've been serving enough time in here to gain some privilege from the screws. I don't do sex talk with strangers, Ruby said dryly. Besides, there are phone lines that offer a much better service than I could.
You think that's all I want you for? Don't put yourself down, detective. You're an intelligent, red-blooded woman. I just want to hear the sound of your voice.
I'll think about it, Ruby said, knowing Nathan would never allow it.
And in the meantime, your victim is languishing in some shoddy hotel room, bleeding out as the rope bites into her neck. Do you know how long I left my victims to die? Tightening and loosening, bringing them back to life only to cut off their air supply. It was a bit like orgasm, the delicious build-up, only to feel the release at the end.
Tell me where Cheryl is, she said, cupping her clenched fist with her other hand.
I don't know where she is, but I can hazard a good guess. Text me from your new phone number. I expect you'll buy a pay-as-you-go.
I don't know your number, Ruby said.
Turns out I'm not the only one that enjoys playing a game. Lenny has it. He'll pass it on when you give him a call.
Why are you doing this? Ruby said, the mention of Nathan's brother adding another sting to the tale. Are you just stringing me along?
A man has to find amusement where he can, Mason grinned.
This better be worthwhile, Ruby said. I need something to go on in the meantime. Mason shrugged.
In my case, the press reported the victims were bound and gagged, but they didn't know that the rope had been taken away and reused. I suppose you could call me the sentimental type. I tied the bottom of each victim's finger with a piece of string to stem the bleeding, then cauterized it to seal the skin. It smelled like a barbecue in that room, but the general public don't like to hear of such things, and it never made the press.
How can you tell me where the victim is being kept if you're not responsible for the current murders? Ruby asked, refusing to join in as he raked over the embers of his crimes. She could have arranged for an official line of questioning, but in this informal setting, there was more information to be gained. He arched an eyebrow.
I know London has changed somewhat in the last 10 years, but I've no doubt that the information I can give you will bring you to their door.
Then tell me now, please. Do you want me to beg, is that it? Mason smiled, looking pleased to have Ruby eating out of the palm of his hand.
I'd like you to do lots of things, but I don't think the guard would approve. In which case, I will have to make do with your phone number instead.
As if on cue, Ruby's phone buzzed in her pocket, providing a much-needed break in conversation. The text was short, but to the point. It was Downs, and Ruby's heart faltered at the sight of his text. We've got him. On our way around there now. Chapter 24. Leaving the prison, Ruby recalled her conversation with Mason, having turned down his request to speak to him on a mobile phone. She should report it, have his cell searched at the very least, but the offer was an ace she was pocketing for now. D.I. Downs was right. He had been toying with her, reeling her in for his own amusement. Was this whole scenario created just because he was bored? The way he looked at her when he spoke about having a rope around her neck. She shuddered. The man made her skin crawl. She turned over the engine of the Ford Focus, allowing it to sync with her phone.
"Hello? Ruby? Where are you?"
Downs's voice boomed in her airspace, a sense of urgency lacing his tone. She turned the volume to a more tolerable level, her car crawling through the car park as she awaited further instructions. She needed time to gather her thoughts, make notes on her conversation with Mason, but time was a luxury in sparse supply. Everything about this day felt like a clock ticking backwards, and Ruby clenched the steering wheel tightly as she spoke.
"I'm just leaving the prison. Tell me where to go and I'll meet you there."
"Thanks to that passcode you got, we were able to access the dating site straight away."
Ruby's heart fluttered in her chest. She would ask him how later on. Right now, they had a life to save. She prayed they weren't too late.
"Give me the address," she said, shoving the car into gear. She flipped on the wipers as a sprinkle of rain dappled the windscreen of her car. Downs relayed the address of a flat on a quiet street 10 minutes away.
"Matthew Johnson's his name," he said. "Softly, softly approach. We don't want to spook him. Don't go in. Do you hear me? Not until backup arrives. There's a unit on its way."
Clicking her seatbelt into place, Ruby pressed down on the indicator before turning left. It was rare to find answers so quickly, and her heart pounded at the prospect of bringing the killer's reign of terror to an end. Mason Gatley had killed 6 women before he was caught. Would the present-day killer have left a breadcrumb trail of clues? Surely if he was colluding with Mason, then he would have ensured he covered his tracks. Or was the internet and its workings beyond his control? Ruby shifted uneasily as her car weaved through traffic, alarm bells signaling in her mind. A sudden thought injected a cold chill down her spine. Perhaps it was a trap. She recalled the last big case she dealt with, and how horrifically that had ended for them all. She turned right, Matthew's street address looming into view. Adrenaline pumped through her body, her left leg shaking as it flooded her veins. She inched down the accelerator, keeping a watchful eye on her speed. At least traffic was reasonable. She would take the bus lane if she had to. Turning into the address, she bumped against the curb, slamming the brakes of her car. So much for the softly, softly approach. She peered up at the block of flats, the rain dampening her hair as she stepped onto the pavement. Was Matthew looking down at her right now? She imagined a silver chain gracing his neck, dipped from the weight of his victim's wedding ring. Was there 1, 2, maybe more? Each one representative of a life lost. Did he smile as he felt them shift from his movement? Take comfort from their presence while he plunged their loved ones into a world full of betrayal and pain? Traffic whooshed past on the main road, and she listened for a siren cutting through the backdrop of city noise she had grown accustomed to. Downs would have instructed her colleagues to make a silent approach. A rustling noise caught her attention, and she walked around the corner to find a dirty-looking Staffordshire Terrier rooting through a pile of bin bags. Snuffling through the leftovers, he clamped his teeth around the carcass of a cooked chicken and regarded her for all of 2 seconds, before giving her a look that suggested he was not in the mood to share.
"Rocky!"
A shrill voice sent the dog running, its tail clamped between his legs.
"Catch him, will ya?"
the woman yelled as the dog skirted past Ruby's legs. She gave an apologetic smile to who she presumed was its owner, as she did not fancy getting bitten today. A middle-aged woman with wet black hair, she was wearing a dressing gown that was struggling to close around her expansive waist. "Sorry,"
Ruby said, approaching her as she held open the door. Do you live here?
Of course I bleed in Livia,
the woman replied, lifting a slippered foot for good measure.
I hardly go out dressed like this now, do I? Why didn't you catch me dog? She's been giving me the slip all day.
Because I've better things to do, Ruby said, lifting her warrant card and peering at the names listed beside the buzzer system on the front door. Do you know a man named Matthew Johnson?
It's just me and me dog, if I can catch the little bugger, she said,
pulling a lighter and a crumpled pack of cigarettes from the pocket of her dressing gown.
I don't pay no attention to what anyone else gets up to around here.
She flicked the lighter into life against the bent-up cigarette hanging from her mouth.
Why? What's he done?
Ruby smiled at her contradiction. Probably nothing, but it's best you go indoors until this is dealt with. She was itching, really itching, to speak to him. But rushing in without adequate cover meant risking his escape. According to the buzzer system, Matthew was on the second floor. She took a few steps back to stare up at the windows.
It's the one with no nets, the woman said, exhaling a long wisp of smoke. Not exactly ass proud, that one.
Blinking against the fine mist of drizzle, Ruby frowned as she saw the telltale signs that something was very wrong. Even from here, where she was standing, she could see the unwanted guests that occupied their suspect's window. At first, she thought the dark shadow on the window was a trick of the light when it began to move from left to right. Shielding her eyes with her hand, she drew a sharp breath as she figured it out.
No, she whispered,
her heart plummeting at the small cloud of blowflies tapping the window for escape. It could only mean one thing. As the police cars drew up behind her, she quickly pointed out what she had found. There was something festering in that room. She only hoped that it was not Cheryl. Had they come too late? Ruby followed them up to the second floor, D.I. Downs by her side.
What kept you?
She rasped, the sound of heavy boots against stairs almost drowning out her words.
Strategy meeting,
Downs said irritably. How come you weren't at the rendezvous point? It was quicker to come here. Ruby agreed that officers should be kept safe, and preempting their arrival made sense. It did not stop her from wanting to rush headfirst into danger, if it meant saving their victim's life.
What's going on?
A thin-faced elderly man half opened his door as officers banged on Matthew's flat. Why don't you get yourself back inside? Ruby said, steering him back in. We'll come and talk to you shortly. In the absence of a response, officers wasted no time in forcing open the door. It flew off its hinges almost immediately. Two swift raps of the enforcer against the hinges was enough to bring the cheap plywood door crashing down. The stench hit them instantly, making Ruby lift the back of her hand to her face. She gave D.I. Downs a look which said she did not hold out much hope. A few stray flies zipped past her as she followed the officers inside. Death had paid a visit. The question was, whose body were they going to find? Chapter 25 Ruby slowly accustomed herself to the humidity in the room, swatting away the flies that had been feasting on the body that lay unmoving on the threadbare bedroom carpet. A uniformed police officer reached out his hand to open the window, battling through the swarm of insects as he choked a cough. "Leave it," Ruby said, knowing that Bones, the crime scene investigator, would want the scene untouched. The presence of blowflies, or blue bottles, as Ruby liked to call them, could be useful to the investigation. Even the tiniest bit of trace evidence could be gleaned from the unlikeliest of places. Their corpse was not going anywhere any time soon. With the rooms secured, D.I. Downs wasted no time in dispersing the officers who had already updated control with their find. It was imperative they move quickly. Establishing the time of death would be a priority for crime scene officers as they tried to work out if the deceased could have been involved in Melissa's death. Lying in a pool of congealed blood, with a bath towel around his waist, the man's bloated body was barely recognizable from the picture on the wall. Livor mortis was evident beneath his skin, the dark discoloration of blood often mistaken for bruising by inexperienced officers at the scene. To Ruby, it was merely the blood pooling in one area, no longer being pumped by the heart. Tearing her eyes away from the corpse, she dipped her hand into the pocket of a leather jacket hanging from the wardrobe door. Sliding out the driver's license with a gloved hand, she confirmed her suspicions. This was the body of Matthew Johnson. But was it the same Matthew Johnson responsible for killing Melissa and kidnapping Cheryl? She checked the date of birth, calculating he was in his early 30s. No doubt there would be lots more clues as to his occupation on the scene. But that was as far as Ruby was willing to go until the CSI arrived. She took a shallow breath, feeling the contents of her last meal make itself known. It was hard to bear the meaty smell that would cling to her clothes long after she was gone. Putrefaction was well underway, and a rough time of death would be identified by the pathologist later on. She stepped aside as Bones, the head CSI, entered the room. His eyes flicked from left to right over his white face mask, making note of the numerous insects buzzing around in the room. "We thought we were coming to arrest our suspect," Ruby said, as means of explanation for her presence in the room. "I heard the update, so I guess you're going to ask me how long he's been here. You know that's a job for the pathologist, don't you?" "We've requested their attendance, but nobody can spare the time," Downs replied. Bones peered at the body as his colleagues set up their equipment to record the scene. "Let me give you a quick lesson on entomology," he said, nodding towards the glass pane which was still pervaded with flies. "When a body is left exposed like this, it's only natural for blowflies to appear. After being laid in a nice moist spot, maggots can hatch within hours if undisturbed. It takes about 12 days for an adult fly to emerge. Then you're talking between 18 to 22 days before the whole cycle begins again." "So he's been dead at least 2.5 weeks, Ruby said. "At least," Bones replied. "But Vera will give you a better idea after the post-mortem. Can't say I envy her there." Ruby exchanged glances with D.I. Downs. If he expected her to attend that, he had another think coming. She withdrew from the room, retracing her steps in order not to disturb the scene. Taking one last glance, she took in the minor details that suggested that Matthew most likely lived alone. It was sad that nobody had discovered his body until now. From the living room, a television hummed, a program providing cheerful background chatter at odds with the violent scene. The double bed was unmade, a pizza takeaway box on the floor. A pair of cufflinks lay on the dresser table under the glow of a bedside light. The fact it was switched on suggested that Matthew could have died during the hours of darkness. That, or the killer had switched it on to divert them from the truth. Another thought sparked in Ruby's mind. Could the person that killed Matthew be responsible for Melissa Sherman's murder too? Perhaps Philip Sherman had decided to get his own revenge after his wife's death. Or had he hired Matthew to murder his wife, then killed Matthew to cover himself? Ruby would get no rest from such theories until firm progress was made. Back at the station, a briefing was quickly assembled as they brought the investigation up to date. Ruby stood with her shirt sleeves rolled up, having left her jacket on the hook in her office. It was another item of clothing that would need a dry clean. For now, such annoyances were minor compared to the thoughts weighing heavy on her mind. After already seeing his driving license, Ruby was not surprised to hear that the corpse had been identified as the same Matthew Johnson who had used the debauchery site. Gratefully, she lifted a mug of tea from the tray being passed around. She was still playing catch-up, and it felt like she was running up an escalator that was going the wrong way. Scene of crime officers had worked diligently to try and glean some clues as to Cheryl's current whereabouts. But there was little forthcoming so far. With evening closing in on day two of Cheryl's kidnapping, they were only too aware of her fate if they failed to locate her tonight. "How did you track down Matthew's address?" she asked, trying to piece together the clues that had led them to his flat. Downs lumbered in beside her, spilling his coffee as he sat. Swearing under his breath, he mopped up the spillage seeping into the paperwork he had just put down. In the absence of DCI Warrow, briefing was in his hands. "That site you gave us wasn't as difficult to infiltrate as we first thought. Once we had the passcode, the tech department was able to access the online profiles. They found Matthew's username, that then linked to a user who seems to be Melissa. Turns out this poor sod had been active on other dating sites too." He glanced around the room. "He's used his credit card to pay a subscription fee. Thanks to Luddy's smooth talking, we were able to secure his bank details and address." Ruby acknowledged Luddy's good work with a nod of the head. He flicked through the pages of his notes. "He mainly advertised on high-class shag sites. Debauchery is by invitation, and they're very particular about who they allow in. Given they know each other, I think that Cheryl and Melissa got in the same way." Ruby nodded, glad that they were both on the same page. "But what about Matthew's flat? Didn't look very high class to me." "I spoke to his landlord," Luddy said. "He was due to move out at the end of the month. Apparently he'd got this posh pad in Knightsbridge. Most likely paid for by a benefactor for a bit of fun on the side," Ruby thought. The press only spoke about mistresses, but Ruby knew there were plenty of powerful women who liked to play away too. She returned her thoughts to the case, her mind buzzing with activity. "Okay," Ruby said, delivering an apologetic smile to her DI for hijacking the briefing. "So, usernames aside, have we any other evidence to suggest that Cheryl and Melissa used debauchery?" "Stationery supplies," Richard piped up, looking mildly embarrassed as all heads turned in his direction. Clearing his throat, he explained his outburst. "Both Cheryl and Melissa made purchases on their husband's credit cards. The transaction shows up as stationery. I did some digging. It's a fake company used to take payments which eventually end up in debauchery's account." "The cheek of it," Ruby said, shocked for the second time that day. "Not just playing away, but letting their husbands pay for it." "It's hiding the lie in plain sight," Richard said, stony-faced. "The last place they would expect to look is right under their very own nose." Ruby leaned back in her chair, leaving Downs to take center stage. "So we're pretty clear on one thing. Matthew Johnson has been murdered, and evidence points to him owning the profile that was visited by Melissa Sherman, and most likely Cheryl Barber, too. But according to Bones, Matthew's been dead for more than 2 weeks." A rumble of chatter filtered around the room. Downs silenced it as he raised his hand. "Our records show that Matthew's profile has been and still is active, which means that somebody is logged in and using it for their own motives. It's my belief that we have an imposter, someone who's posing as Matthew to lure these women in." Pushing back his chair, he walked to the whiteboard. "We've got to preempt this killer's movements," Down said, tapping the photos of Melissa's crime scene, which were pinned to the board. "Are they using only high-class hotels without CCTV? 3 days that poor lass was in that hotel room, while people walked past in the corridor outside. During that time,
Our killer casually ordered room service and watched cable TV. Can you imagine that? His eyes wide, he glanced around the room. Even after he killed her, he was in no hurry to leave. He took his time cleaning up after himself, wiping away every trace. The involvement of such a cold-hearted killer means there's less chance of them leaving evidence at the scene.
But surely that must have aroused suspicion, DC Ludgrove piped up.
Staff are vague on details, but then again, they're known for being discreet. Their reputation will mean more to them than helping us out.
He's right, Ruby thought. The only thing that staff would confirm was that the room had been booked by a man. At last, they were getting somewhere, as the results of their investigations began to filter in. But her optimism was tinged with sadness, as she knew, deep down, that for Cheryl, they would now probably be too late.
Chapter 26 Matthew sat on the floor, legs spread amongst the remnants of things he had collected. To the right of him was a lock of Melissa's hair and a sequin that had fallen from her dress. To the left was Cheryl's false fingernail and a tangle of hairs he had plucked from her head. His bedroom rug was adorned with his trinkets, but none were as precious as the wedding rings nestled against his collarbone on the chain beneath his shirt. He clutched the cordless phone in his hand. His calls to Sanity Line helped maintain balance in the world. Nobody knew why he was suffering, only that he needed help. Sleep evaded him since he had murdered Melissa. He had lain in his bed, silent prayers crossing his lips as he stared at the crucifix over his door. He hoped it would be easier the second time around. Each encounter brought its own risks, and after the first one, he considered walking away. But these women, these sluts, they just kept contacting him. Why wouldn't they leave him alone? He had told himself to stay offline. What these women did wasn't his business. But the truth would gnaw on him like a hungry rat on a bone. His mind would not rest as it conjured up images of their despicable acts. He clenched his teeth. Something had to be done. Shoving away their belongings, he rose to his feet. He caught his reflection in the mirror, stepping closer for a better look. Was he changing? Was his anger visible on the outside now? He was taking a risk having their belongings here. What if he got caught? Who would carry on his good work then? With shaking fingers, he dialed the number of the only people who understood.
"Hello, Sanity Line," the call taker answered.
Relief swept over Matthew as he recognized their voice. It was Laura. He imagined her sitting behind her desk, playing with her hair as she took his call. He was so relieved to talk to her that he found himself babbling as he delivered a diluted tale of his recent encounter with Cheryl. Laura waited patiently while he brought her up to speed. He glossed over the ending, his ramblings focused on wondering why people stray. The sudden sense of confusion he had felt when things had ended so abruptly between them. After days of online flirting, it was over. Soon she would be over. She would never stray again. So why wasn't he satisfied? Why did he feel the need to carry on with someone else? Following in Mason Gatley's footsteps was often unappealing, because a voice deep inside told him it was wrong. "First Melissa, and now Cheryl," he sniffled, his words ragged and disjointed. "I must be a glutton for punishment."
"It's normal to feel like that when a relationship comes to an end," Laura said. "Perhaps you need to look at why you're attracted to married women."
"As in rake over my childhood memories?" Matthew asked. "Believe me, you don't want to go there." His stomach tightened as the humiliation of his youth came back to haunt him.
He never envisioned life would take him to this place. I confronted Cheryl and Melissa about their behavior. They said they were sorry, that they only wanted a bit of fun.